Thanks, Natalia. Hey, everyone. It's good to be here. I was actually, so I came from Oakland yesterday and I got on the plane. And you know, when you sit down and the captain gets on the overhead and greets you and they were like, yeah, welcome on board. And they went on to say, you know, happy 4th of July and like big round of applause for all of our servicemen and women who keep us safe and defend our democracy. And I just thought to myself, I was like, thank gosh, I'm on my way to a socialist conference. This weekend is always a much needed refreshment. So I titled this talk, Imperialism and Anti-Imperialism Today. And there's really no shortage of imperialism in the world today. I'm sure we could all name two or three ongoing wars and another two or three that seem to be on the brink of exploding. I think just last couple weeks ago, Trump ordered military strikes on Iran, and then literally as the planes are in the air, he reverses his decision. So clearly the left needs a way to explain endless war, occupation, devastating economic sanctions, and all other forms of imperialism. And we also need some ideas about how to fight back. In the absence of a desperately needed anti-war movement, I think we've had less opportunity to think through, debate, and develop anti-imperialist politics on the US left. And that's just one of the reasons that conferences like this are so valuable, and I'm really looking forward to our discussion here today. Before I get into current debates on the left surrounding imperialism and anti-imperialism, I want to start with how these questions developed in the history of the socialist movement. In the early 1900s, Russian revolutionaries Vladimir Lenin and Nikolai Bukharin developed what is called the classical Marxist theory of imperialism. And many scholars have updated, corrected, and expanded upon this theory since. Lenin and Bukharin wrote their respective books on imperialism in order to explain what they were seeing around them at the end of the 19th century. They were seeing the scramble for Africa in the mid to late 19th century, Spanish and Portuguese conquest in the Americas, raw materials being extracted from colonies. There was a consolidation of empire at the turn of the century, and tensions between great powers exploded in August 1914 with the beginning of World War I. In the decade leading up to the war, the Second International, which was a group of socialist parties from around the world, they had passed resolutions condemning the brewing conflict and pledging opposition if and when it broke out. And they did so on the basis of internationalism, the idea that workers of the world have more in common with one another than with their national ruling classes. And the idea that the struggle for socialism is going to require solidarity across borders. The very promise of the Second International was internationalism. At the opening Congress in 1889, Paul Lafargue greeted representatives from over 24 countries with the words, "We gather here not under the banner of the tricolor or any other national colors. We gather here under the banner of the red flag, the flag of the international proletariat, or working class." However, when World War I began, socialist party after socialist party lined up behind their own national ruling class to support the war. They justified this betrayal of international solidarity by calling the war a defensive war, so saying that Britain and France, etc., had a right to defend their borders in order to safeguard democracy and to lay the most promising foundation for the future fight for socialism. German socialists claimed the war was progressive because the defeat of Russia would liberate Poland and other nationalities oppressed by the Tsar. There were only a few socialist groups that denounced the war and refused to support their own government. The largest of these groups was the Bolshevik wing of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. And members Lenin and Bukharin wrote these books. Everyone here, they actually didn't have Bukharin in the book room, but, or maybe I couldn't find it. But they wrote these books not just as theoretical texts, but as political interventions into a debate that had torn apart the Second International. They understood the Great War as an imperialist war, one in which the working people of the world had no stake. Their analysis identifies imperialism as a necessary feature of capitalism. Lenin writes, "If it were necessary to give the briefest possible definition of imperialism, we should have to say that imperialism is the monopoly stage of capitalism. So he goes on to outline five essential features of modern imperialism, and he doesn't get everything right. Capitalism's development was a bit more dynamic and complex than his analysis suggests, but I think his underlying argument remains true. As capital becomes more and more concentrated and centralized, with fewer and fewer capitalists controlling larger and larger units of production, competition between capitalist powers intensifies. Bukharin takes Lenin's starting point and goes further. He argues that alongside this tendency towards concentration is a tendency for the state and economy to become more closely integrated, and in some cases actually fuse, as in the case of state capitalism. At the same time, capitalism has a tendency towards internationalization, as the voracious needs of capital drive it beyond national borders in search of new markets, raw materials, cheap labor. Capitalists thus come to depend upon their home states to intervene globally, to secure markets, and redivide the world among themselves. In summary, imperialism is the division of the world based on stronger nations militarily and economically dominating weaker ones. It's a lot of theory for Friday morning. Okay. So one consequence of imperialism is nationalism. As stronger nations impose their will on weaker ones, the resistance to this domination often appears as nationalism. In the 1860s, Marx developed his ideas on national oppression by observing the resistance to British colonialism in India and the Irish national struggle. He concluded that socialists must support the anti-colonial movement in India and the demands of Irish nationalists. Without solidarity across borders, the international workers' movement would be weakened. And as long as England was a colonial power, the English working class was held back. He also makes an important distinguishes, importantly, nationalism of an oppressor nation, which is always reactionary, and nationalism of an oppressed nation, which can be liberatory, like Irish nationalism or Palestinian nationalism. He wrote, quote, "The English working class will never be able to do anything decisive here in England before they separate their attitude towards Ireland definitively from that of the ruling classes, and not only make common cause with the Irish, but even take the initiative in dissolving the Union established in 1801. And this must not be done out of sympathy with the Irish, but as a demand on the interests of the English proletariat." So debate about what attitude to take towards struggles for national liberation gripped the socialist movement at the turn of the 20th century. On one side of the debate was Polish revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg, who argued that socialists should not recognize the right of nations to self-determination. The specific focus of her analysis was Poland, which was a colony of Tsarist Russia at the time. Tendencies within the Polish socialist movement had adopted Polish nationalism, but in a way that subordinated the class struggle to demands for autonomy. Luxemburg argued that Polish independence was a capitulation to bourgeois nationalism and a distraction from international working class solidarity. She also argued that the economies of Russia and Poland had become so intertwined that self-determination was essentially a moot point, and that more generally, self-determination under capitalism was an illusion. And there's a kernel of truth to that. But Lenin disagreed with Luxemburg, and drawing from Marx, he took support for the nationalism of the oppressed and put it into action. He argued that socialists must uphold the right of oppressed nations to self-determination as a basic principle of democracy and in order to have the fullest expansion of democracy under capitalism. Years later, following the 1917 Russian Revolution, Lenin expanded on these ideas and advocated that socialists offer a critical defense of anti-colonial nationalism. As cross-class alliances, national liberation struggles shouldn't be confused or conflated with working-class self-emancipation. Thus, socialists should ally with these movements, but not try to put a communist cloak around them, pretending they're something they're not, or abandoning the independent workers' movement be it only in embryo. Lastly, the principle of the right of nations to self-determination must be applied politically with regard for the nuances and specificities of each individual case. It doesn't guarantee support for every national demand because some are reactionary, and we can think about, you know, the Zionist demand for independence in historical Palestine, not something socialists support. It's a nationalism that's predicated upon the dispossession of indigenous people. So now I want to turn to two key dangers that the left faces today while grappling with the question of imperialism. And the first is social patriotism. Social patriotism is when socialists demonstrate allegiance to their own state or ruling class rather than opposing it. And the most prominent historical example of this is those socialist parties that backed their own governments during the First World War. This was a massive capitulation, and it ripped apart the socialist movement, so it's worth examining what led to it. It wasn't simply the result of personal failings on the part of particular leaders. These were smart, committed socialists. Rather, it was the result of a growing political divide in the socialist movement between revolutionaries, so those who view a rupture with the existing state as a precondition for socialism, and reformists, those who believe in gradual change through existing institutions to fundamentally transform society. Strategic differences had emerged over the question of how we get to socialism. In Germany, Edward Bernstein argued for a parliamentary road to socialism on the basis that advanced capitalism had created the conditions in which socialism could be legislated in through the existing state. His analysis placed a premium on the SPD, the German Socialist Party, winning elections. In an excellent article in Jacobin magazine, historian Sean Larson writes, "Electioneering came with the insistence that politicians could hand socialism down from their state offices. The party's priorities had shifted. No longer did it fight for workers' self-activity, with parliament serving to amplify those possibilities. Instead, mass mobilization was subordinated to electoral needs, to the relationships between party officials and bourgeois politicians, and to secret negotiations in the Reichstag's smoky halls." When World War I broke out, the SPD and other parties of the Second International that had adopted reformist practices were unable to offer a political alternative to that war. Today, the new socialist movement in the U.S. has not faced a World War I level political decision, at least not yet. However, we see social patriotism on the broader left. So when liberals argue passionately for progressive policies at home, but when it comes to foreign policy, you know, hesitate to challenge U.S. empire, there's often an underlying nationalist assumption that the U.S. should remain number one. In the recent democratic debates, all of the candidates seemingly agree that China is a threat to the imperial power and profits of the U.S., reflecting a growing consensus among liberal politicians. This May, the Bernie Sanders campaign criticized Joe Biden for having a soft stance on China, tweeting, "It's wrong to pretend that China isn't one of our major economic competitors. When we are in the White House, we will win that competition by fixing our trade policies." Similar hints of social patriotism have appeared on the socialist left. I read an article recently that was making a patriotic argument for democratic socialism here in the US on the basis that we could compete with Chinese capitalism that way. Socialists have to cut against the idea that US workers are on the same side as US capitalists in the confrontation with China, and the idea that Chinese workers are responsible for the US's economic woes. As inter-imperial rivalry intensifies between the US and China, the socialist movement must oppose US imperialism and build solidarity with Chinese workers. And we must do this while avoiding the trap of giving political support to the Chinese regime. This is a regime that exploits workers, oppresses nations like Tibet and national minorities like the Muslim Uyghurs, and increasingly exploits third world countries for raw materials and export markets. And this brings me to the second danger that the left faces on the question of imperialism, and that's campism. So this is the idea that the world is divided into two camps. We have a US camp that's capitalist and imperialist and bad, true, of the US, and an anti-US camp that is Maybe it's socialist, it's anti-imperialist, it opposes U.S. hegemony. Campism means supporting this anti-U.S. camp, using the logic of the enemy of my enemy as my friend, or supporting it out of some sense that it is a progressive alternative to U.S. In both cases, the rhetoric of anti-imperialism is often used to justify this support. The politics of campism assume that the U.S. is the only oppressor in the world, or that it's the only one worth opposing because it is the greatest imperial power. Thus, the conclusion is that the left's sole task is to oppose U.S. imperialism. This is a common sentiment among liberal anti-war groups that rightly denounce U.S. intervention throughout the world, but suspend criticism of states outside of the U.S.'s sphere of influence. So, for example, many U.S. anti-war groups correctly oppose the U.S.-backed coup in Venezuela, but they remain silent on the crimes of the Maduro regime. There are several fundamental problems with campism. The first is that it suffers from a West centrism that refuses to recognize the agency of people in other parts of the world and the reality that they too can oppress people or fight against that oppression. And there's also some Orientalism in the suggestion that people in places like Venezuela, Hong Kong, Bahrain don't have the desire or capacity to struggle for basic democratic rights, many rights that we have to a much greater degree, one in the U.S. Over the past month in Hong Kong, there's been this incredible protest movement in opposition to a bill that would have allowed China to extradite Hong Kong residents. And so Hong Kong's an autonomous territory of China, and this bill is an infringement upon their autonomy. And this massive protest movement has erupted around it. A recent statement by a U.S. anti-war group opposed this movement on the basis that these protesters are simply puppets of the U.S. This completely erases their agency and denies solidarity with the struggle for greater democracy. A second issue with seeing the U.S. as the only oppressor in the world is that it relies on an outdated assessment of U.S. imperialism. There's no question that the U.S. remains the dominant superpower today in terms of economic and military might. But we no longer have a unipolar world order as we did after the collapse of the USSR, when the U.S. emerged as this unrivaled superpower. Since then, economic and military setbacks have weakened the U.S.'s relative position, and we've seen a shift to what Marxist theorist Ashley Smith calls a multipolar, so many poles, yet asymmetrical, so they're not all the same valence, world order. The economic conditions that shape today are a result of the long neoliberal boom from 1982 to 2007, which created new centers of capital accumulation, most importantly in China. So while the U.S. was hit hard by the 2008 Great Recession, China hyper-stimulated its economy and fended off stagnation. Within 10 years, China's share of the global GDP is projected to outpace the U.S.'s, and this would be the first time since World War II that the U.S. has been outpaced. China has also been establishing geopolitical alliances and economic institutions that are outside of the U.S.'s sphere of influence. And a really excellent example of this is their $1 trillion One Belt, One Road project. So this is an infrastructure project that's trying to connect several continents on China's economic terms. And the U.S. isn't really pleased about this, and last month significantly upped its investments in Africa explicitly to counter China's influence. On the military front, President Xi Jinping has modernized the Chinese Navy and expanded its presence in the South China Sea. Scholars have contested China's rise and whether it represents a challenge to U.S. dominance, but I think it's undeniable that China is an emerging world power that has imperial ambitions. Russia and Iran are two other countries that are contending for power in this new world order. They have expanded their regional influence, particularly in areas where the U.S. empire's grip has loosened due to military setbacks and the upheaval of the 2011 Arab Spring. It's primarily these countries, China, Russia, and Iran, that form that multipolar world order alongside the U.S. today. And it's dynamic. It's ever-forming. As the left, it will become increasingly important how we understand and respond to inter-imperial rivalry. saying that the most radical thing you can do is support the enemies of the US actually reveals a quite liberal view of imperialism. It assumes that there are good governments and bad governments instead of understanding imperialism as integral to capitalism, with no good and bad guys among capitalist regimes. This framework also assumes that the fundamental divide in the world is between nations instead of social class, and this can result in papering over class distinctions and oppression within a state. A form of campism that is becoming more common on the left is a sort of neo-Stalinism. And in short, it looks like apologizing for Russian imperialism. These ideas are rooted in the counter-revolution that followed the 1917 Russian Revolution. As part of Stalin's effort to promote socialism in one country, he justified Russia's imperialist practices against non-Russian nationalists and neighboring states. And he did this in the name of anti-imperialism, so really turning Lenin's theory on its head. Many socialists did not recognize the Soviet state as a perversion of Marxism and continued to distort anti-imperialism by supporting Soviet invasion, occupation of Eastern European states. During the Cold War, they supported the USSR as a socialist camp against the capitalist camp of the US. At this time, a different part of the socialist movement developed the slogan, "Neither Washington nor Moscow, but international socialism," rejecting both imperial camps and identifying a third camp. Today, campus arguments are cropping up again, and nowhere has this pseudo-anti-imperialist logic been more apparent than in the left's response to the Syrian revolution. In 2011, the Syrian people rose up in a genuine popular uprising for democracy, equality, and liberation. And this was part of a wave of protests across the Middle East and North Africa, known as the Arab Spring. In Syria, President Bashar al-Assad responded with a brutal counter-revolution that is ongoing. Iranian intervention in 2013 saved the regime. Its army was on the verge of collapse due to mass defections. And in 2015, Russian intervention fortified Assad's counter-revolution. Sections of the left questioned whether there was a popular uprising in Syria at all, calling the movement a US-backed coup to replace the anti-imperialist, pro-Palestinian, and sometimes even socialist, Bashar al-Assad. Yeah, any honest assessment of Assad's relationship to the US and Israel quickly dispels that myth. And if that's not sufficient, his bloody, brutal, sectarian response to a popular movement against him should confirm that he's not a friend of the left. The campus left correctly opposed, US intervention in Syria and explicitly backed Russian and Iranian intervention to support Assad. So I remember going to demonstrations in the Bay Area, hands-off Syria demonstrations, where you'd see people waving the regime flag. And at other demonstrations, people would hold up Assad's picture, and there were signs that said, like, "God bless Syria, God bless Assad." So this position abandons the principle of internationalism by defending an authoritarian strongman who supposedly resists US hegemony instead of siding with Syrians who are risking their lives in pursuit of democracy and liberation. And this is a distortion of anti-imperialism. In some cases, Assad apologists have slipped into Islamophobia. Journalists like Max Blumenthal, Rania Halik, and others have smeared the White Helmets, which is essentially a volunteer group of rescue workers who spend their time pulling people out from under buildings that have been hit by Assad's planes. So they've been smearing this group as Al-Qaeda affiliates. And this is just one example of Assad apologists conflating all of those who support the Syrian revolution with terrorists. This effort to vilify ordinary Syrians falsely and very dangerously equates the majority Sunni Muslim opposition with extremism, which is taking a page directly out of the US's war on terror logic. So what does genuine anti-imperialism look like today? Anti-imperialism means opposing all imperialisms. It means standing in solidarity with people oppressed by any government, regardless of that government's relationship to the United States. We can and must do this while opposing our own government's military action and foreign intervention. It's true that the main enemy is at home, and we have a special obligation in the belly of the beast to organize, but we don't do so by appealing to the governments of Iran or Russia. We do so through mass mobilizations from below that stand in solidarity with struggles for self-determination, workers' movements, and national liberation everywhere. This position reflects a commitment to genuine internationalism. And we can apply this general framework to the case of Iran. So as I'm sure we all know, Trump has intensified what's been a decades-long effort to promote regime change in Iran. And in response, most of the left correctly opposes US economic sanctions and war threats, but remains uncritical of the Iranian regime. This response provides cover to an oppressive theocracy and ignores the struggles of workers, women, and oppressed minorities in Iran. It also fails to grapple with these Iran's interventions in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen. In the words of Iranian journalist Rama Bozari, "Trapped between the Trump administration and the domestic oppressors are ordinary people. They are offered a choice between imperialism and authoritarianism. However miserable their situation might be, they continue to reject both." So our solidarity must be with those people, neither Washington nor Tehran. One of the most important contemporary internationalist struggles is actually happening within the borders of the so-called United States. Indigenous peoples' ongoing resistance to settler colonialism and oppression manifested in the 2016 Standing Rock protest movement against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Nick Estes, a co-founder of the Red Nation and a Lakota historian, writes in his fantastic new book, which you can pick up in the book room. He writes, "The theft of indigenous lands and the subdual of indigenous nations is an essential part of global imperialism. Recognizing this, the international indigenous movement continues its work today, though often quietly. This is necessary because the Indian wars have never truly ended. The Treaty Council saw its sacred duty as ending imperialism abroad by ending it at home, and at Standing Rock in 2016, this spirit of internationalism was visible once again as a parade of indigenous nations from around the world showed up in solidarity." The struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline also united indigenous and non-indigenous people who joined the movement. Black Lives Matter, Palestinian organizations, religious groups, unions, socialists, veterans, like thousands of veterans. These are people who've often seen the most brutal firsthand experience of US imperialism. They went to Standing Rock. And this is an inspiring example of genuine internationalist anti-imperialism today. Historically, the socialist movement has stumbled on the question of imperialism. Today, with an escalating migrant crisis, the threat of nuclear war, the rise of far right, the stakes are very high. We cannot abandon internationalism. We cannot abandon the right of nations to self-determination. And we cannot abandon the revolutionary fight for socialism. Imperialism is not innate to human society. It had a beginning, and it can and must have an end. So I'm really looking forward to the discussion, learning from you all. These are really big, complicated questions. There's no easy answers, and I certainly don't have all the answers. So please share, particularly any disagreements. Looking forward to it. Thank you.